In birdwatching terms, what is a nemesis bird?
Oh, man, I think you should start with that, Braden.
A nemesis bird mainly can be, like, we have two examples of nemesis birds. Our main one, which most recently became not a nemesis bird anymore, is called a snow bunting, which is a bird that we've looked for maybe half a dozen or a dozen different times and just never found. We've been so unlucky, we've just never seen it before. And so a nemesis bird is sort of, it's past a bird you've never seen before. It's to the point where you've looked for it a lot and just never found it.
Is there a certain emotional quality attached to the nemesis bird?
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. And birds that didn't used to be nemesis birds can become nemesis birds. And it really starts pissing you off when you don't see them.
Yeah, snow buntings were really angering for us.
Yeah. Like, even when Braden and I did a big weekend that's mentioned in the book, over Memorial Day, we wanted to see how many birds we could see. Braden and Nick Ramsey kept seeing dippers, and I kept missing them. And by the end of the weekend, I was really getting annoyed by that, you know? So they can really kind of get under your skin.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Sneed Collard and his son Braden about warblers and woodpeckers, a father-son big year of birding. Stay tuned.
Of course, this book is inspired by the 2011 film The Big Year, featuring Owen Wilson and Steve Martin. Will you just kick us off by reading part of the beginning?
The idea to do a big year had first entered our brains thanks to a movie my wife, Amy, had picked for us to watch a couple of years earlier. That movie, based on the entertaining book The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl Obsession, featured a trio of rabid birders in pursuit of the North American single-year species count record. Neither Braden nor I had read the book, but the film version starred three of our favorite actors, Owen Wilson, Jack Black, and Steve Martin. And we enjoyed it so much that we watched it two more times before returning it to Crazy Mike's video down the street. I'll admit that before seeing the movie, Braden and I had never heard of a big year. That's not to say that we didn't take an interest in birds. Every year we gave money to the Audubon Society, and I'd written four children's books focusing on the wonder and diversity of bird life. For several years, our family also had enjoyed watching and identifying birds that visited our backyard feeder. Black-capped chickadees, dark-eyed juncos, and white-breasted nuthatches, along with occasional more dazzling species such as evening grosbeaks, American goldfinches, and once a lazuli bunting. Still, it wasn't until we watched The Big Year that Braden, not quite 11 at the time, embraced birding for himself. With the closing credits still rolling, he turned to me and said, "Daddy, we should do a big year." "Okay," I said.
Braden, you're a teenager now. What got you into birding in the first place?
Sort of like that passage conveyed, really watching the movie The Big Year got me into it. Like, since I'd been really young, I've been really into animals of all kinds. And I've also been into, like, collecting things. And so I think that sort of when I saw the movie The Big Year, the idea of, like, collecting birds for a year sort of struck me. And I decided I wanted to try that out. And we've just stuck with it ever since.
And for those of us unfamiliar, can you give a brief account of the rules of the American Birders Association? Because there are certain ways that you have to count how you see a bird, how it fits the regulations?
Yes, it's really on the honor system, the whole thing. You can either see a bird or you can identify it from its call. Now, we, especially during our big year, knew very few bird calls, so we made ourselves see every bird. Do you remember any that we identified just from a call?
No.
I don't think so either. Yeah. And I'm still that way. Braden is learning the calls very well. But as I explain in the book, my hearing started to go south during that big year. And even with hearing aids that I have now, it's more difficult for me to learn a new call. I hear it, but it's not a natural sound always. And so they trust you to evaluate your own abilities and to make the identifications. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't some controversy. We've talked to some very prominent birders lately who have deep suspicions about other birders and whether they're really seeing these birds that they put on their list. But I would guess that 99.9% of the birders out there are very honorable people. And the people who are trying to set records usually have photographic evidence that they've seen the birds. Mm-hmm. And that's always a good idea if you're a real hardcore birder, you know.
Right. And Braden, one of the things that impressed me about your character in the book, which is that you held yourself to a very high standard about seeing the birds. And there's one point when your dad is like, oh, just count it. I saw it. You can take credit. And you were adamant that you needed to see it for yourself. What do you know about that part of you that really has this integrity?
I just know that I've always had it, and I've definitely got it from my dad and my mom. But also it's like, again, birding is based on the honor system, and that's partly because, well, you can lie about it, but you're not earning anything, really. People might be like, oh, well, he saw that bird, but if you know that you didn't see it, you didn't really win anything by lying, you know? So I want to make sure that I've seen or heard the bird and know how to identify it before I count it.
There's a great quote by Owen Wilson in the movie The Big Year to that effect, because other birders suspect him. And he just said, who wants to be that guy? Yeah. The guy that cheats on birds, you know? And I think it reflects how almost all birders feel.
One of the things the book taught me was about the alpha code of birds. Can you just describe this for listeners?
Well, I didn't really know much about it until I think it was during our big weekend with Nick Ramsey. You guys started testing each other on these four-letter codes and then making up new codes for some other birds. So why don't you describe what the codes are?
Well, yeah. I remember the first time I was introduced to it is we were birding with Nick, and Nick was like, there's an AMRO. And we're like, what's an AMRO? American Robin. And it's just sort of this system that people use to make it easier and shorter to say what bird they saw or quickly jot it down. And it's with one-word bird names, it's the first four letters of the name. With two-word bird names, it's the first two letters of the first name and the first two letters of the second name. With three, it's the first of the first of the second, and the first two of the third. And with four, I'm assuming it's just the first of every word.
But it's funny, there are always exceptions to it either, because yeah. Some birds end up would have the same code.
Right.
Like, yeah, like Canada goose and cackling goose would have the same code. So they just have really obscure codes that don't make sense and makes the reason they have alpha codes useless. So
it's funny, though, in every area of expertise, I think people who know about that area have their own vocabulary.
The language.
They kind of use it to lord it over other people, you know, and that happens with birds too, because people just toss out four-letter codes, and it's almost a test, like, do you know what I'm talking about?
Right, the secret knock.
Yeah, exactly, a secret knock.
You've mentioned Nick Ramsey, so I want you to talk a little bit about who is he, where is he from?
Nick got into birding a long time before I did. When he was about like 3 or 4, his dad took him up to see snowy owls in probably Polson, but it was before the big Polson outbreak recently.
And Polson is where?
South end of Flathead Lake.
In Montana.
In Montana,
yes.
Right.
Which is a really close place for snowy owls to be. And so ever since that experience, Nick has been hooked on birds. And I discovered this in 6th grade when I started going to the same school as him. And we just sort of bonded over this that, wow, this is crazy. There are two of us that like birds. And Nick is a much better birder than both of us. He knows all of the Montana birds by sight and by call. He birds much more. And part of that is because he lives on MPG Ranch, which is a big ranch south of town. His dad manages it. And so he just has all of these amazing experiences. He lives sort of on the edge of the wilderness there.
And the ranch is dedicated to scientific research and ecological restoration. And so there are scientists hanging out there too. And they often rely on Nick to show them stuff because he knows so much about the environment down there and especially about the animals.
Yeah. And MPG, it's sort of a preserve. So like as far as Western Montana is considered, it's probably like the largest prairie in Western Montana that's just completely preserved.
Yeah, we've been fortunate to know him, and we've had a lot of great birding experiences with him. The year following our big year in 2016, Braden, Nick, and I took a six-day trip to eastern Montana, and it was just epic. We just saw so many incredible birds on that trip. Nick spotted a lot of them, like greater sage grouse and upland sandpiper, things like that, yeah, that we'd never seen before. And it was just a blast.
I'm the sister of a birder, a very serious birder, who's the top e-birder in South Sudan.
Wow.
And I have watched him travel to far and distant places, including the Aleutians. And I often just shake my head at what he does. And so I want you to explain to me what is in the heart and the mind of a birder.
That's a really good question. And it's probably hard to analyze intellectually. It's just like this switch flips. And suddenly, you just want to be out there seeing birds. I think counting them helps. Having a goal helps to look for birds. But, you know, I'd always had kind of a casual interest in birds. But before Braden and I started doing it together, I could take them or leave them, kind of. You know, I liked them, but I wasn't rabid about them. But as soon as Braden and I started going out looking for them, and I dedicated myself to learning more about them, led by Braden, he would just spend nights poring over bird guides. And so we both started learning them together. And I don't know if this is how you felt, but just somewhere along the way, I just wanted to bird almost everywhere I went. And I'm still like that. I had a work trip to San Antonio last weekend, and most people go to San Antonio to drink and eat food. And I thought down the Riverwalk, well, I wonder what birds are really here. And so I just spent 2 days birding that area, and I was astonished by the birds I found down there. What would you say about it, Ray?
Yeah, and like you said, sort of a switch flips when you become a birder. It's impossible to turn the switch off. Even if I didn't want to be a birder, I'd be sitting in class and I'd look outside and see a bird and immediately I'd identify it just because that's what birders do, regardless of whether we want to or not.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Braden and Snead Collard about warblers and woodpeckers, a father-son big year of birding. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
Braden, have you read the book?
This book? Yes. Yeah.
He also helped me proofread it as well. He caught a couple of really important errors in the book with my identifications and things. He said, Daddy, that wasn't a so-and-so. That was a so-and-so. I go, oh, yeah, you're right. You know, so he was very helpful with that. And I don't know if you know, we also write a birding blog now called fathersonbirding.com. And we try to alternate writing blogs, and we kind of act as our own writers group with each other to edit and make comments. I posted one this morning and let him read it before I posted, and he made two very good comments on it. And So that's a fun way to kind of continue the conversation after the book came out.
I want to stay talking about the father-son relationship here. There are some really funny moments, and there are some tantrums in the book. My favorite moment, I think, is Sneed, when you go to Eastern Montana and you call home because you've just seen a bird you're so excited about. And Braden, you're like, man, I missed it. and you like offer this fatherly wisdom, which is like, son, be happy for me. Like, this is what we do as a team. And so I just want to know, how did you negotiate sulking versus celebrating versus teamwork versus individual birding?
Well, I think, and I'll let Braden weigh in on this, but I think we have a huge amount of respect for each other and each other's birding abilities and other abilities as well. And so while it's kind of up to me to organize the trips and, of course, pay for them, right, I really rely on Braden to lead the way with identifying the birds and figuring out where we're going to go. And a lot of that developed through the process that's in the book, you know, through that particular big year. But birding can also be exhausting, and we get tired, and we're going to have tantrums when that happens sometimes. And so, but I'd say there's just a basic level of trust that we're on each other's side, you know. And if I see a bird, I want Braden to see it. And if he sees one, he wants me to see it. Mm-hmm. And we do the best we can to make that happen.
Yeah, there's always a feeling of loss if one of us sees a really cool bird, but the other one doesn't. It's not usually viewed as a good thing only if one of us sees it. So,
how did you make it through those moments that were either boring or frustrating, or you're in traffic, you know, like, I mean, how did you survive?
We just eventually, again, we have so much respect for each other that we just eventually made up, and we decided that, well, it's not really worth it to keep going on like this. We're going to see more birds if we have good attitudes, you know, so.
And we have to give ourselves attitude talks. I know I do, you know, like stuck in traffic in Houston. You just, okay, just relax. There's nothing you can do about it. There might be some interesting birds that we see while we're stuck in traffic here or whatever. But it is, yeah, traveling, it's tiring and it's demanding in a lot of ways. But also we're kept so busy too. Like even during frustrating moments, Braden is navigating for us using Google or whatever we've got. And looking out the window, and I'm trying to stay on the road, making sure I know where we're going and that sort of thing. So there's really never a dull moment.
Speaking of being on the road, it feels like a travelogue or a road novel. And there's some emphasis on what's being eaten on the trip, including some diabolical Mexican food, peanut butter sandwiches, Starbucks, Taiwanese pork buns. Why do you think food became a natural character in the book?
That's a good question. I think we both love food a lot. And part of the joy of travel is to find good food. The other thing is I love Montana, but the ethnic food offerings here are a little slim. So we knew, tell them about Din Tai Fung, for instance.
Oh, yeah. So, like, we discovered our favorite restaurant in Taiwan in, like, 2014 or mm-hmm. so. And we discovered that it was moving into the West Coast. So we immediately, when we learned we were going to California, we started looking to see if there was a Din Tai Fung nearby, and there was. And we've just always made sure that if there's been one, we hit it on our trips.
Yeah, it just makes the whole trip an experience more fun. And me, I have a passion for Mexican food, so any place I'm within shooting range of Mexican food, gonna try to go there.
Mm-hmm. Plus, a lot of birding, the best birding takes place in the morning. So in general, birders go birding, see some awesome birds, and by then they're hungry. So food just naturally comes after the birds.
Yeah, either for a late breakfast or early lunch or whatever. That happened over and over again on the trip, whether it was barbecue our first day in Texas or getting Mexican food after our day at the San Bernardino Wildlife Refuge in southern Arizona.
There's a funny reflection that you make about going camping in Montana. You write, "Even at Braden's age, I had never fathomed this concept of escaping town only to make your camping experience as crazy, hectic, and noisy as your everyday life." And then you couch that by saying, "Maybe I'm just not a good American." I just want to know, does that sensibility reflect your work as a birder? I mean, do those two things go hand in hand?
I think they do. I think they do. I think I've always, like Braden, I was a Boy Scout when I was a kid and learned that camping is you get out there and you don't have radios with you. You are trying to be as in tune with your environment as you can. And with birding, it's the same thing. When I go to a city, and I don't know if Braden does this, but probably, I'm looking not at the beautiful buildings and things like that. I'm looking at what habitat has this city managed to set aside, and what little pieces of habitat are tucked between the skyscrapers and things like that. And that tells me a lot more about a place than their arts or anything like that. That's what I really appreciate. And that's why, like, for instance, San Antonio was so interesting last weekend when I was there. I'm looking for the little patches of oak trees that they hadn't cut down. So,
will you read one more short passage?
Of course. Be delighted. So instead of taking the ferry, we decided to go to another place that would take us through the town of Port Arthur, which is one of the huge centers of petroleum exploration, shipping, refining in the country. So I'll just read a passage about our visit there. "Everyone who drives a car should visit Port Arthur and Sabine Pass to learn what our collective thirst for fossil fuels does to the environment. With wall-to-wall refineries, liquefied natural gas terminals, and offshore drilling barges, the place offers an end-of-the-world Mad Max landscape, complete with pipes belching flames, stadium-sized storage containers, and hundreds of inebriating carcinogens wafting through the air." "Why do they do this?" Braden asked, aghast at the industrial nightmare surrounding us. "They do this because we all drive cars," I told him. "The only way to get rid of this is to get rid of gasoline-powered automobiles and fossil fuels." "We should do that," he said. "No argument here," I said, punching the accelerator of our supercharged six-cylinder rental car. We were so impressed by the scale of the petroleum operations that at one point I pulled over to take a picture with my cell phone. I couldn't have been out of our car for 10 seconds when a security detail in a black truck pulled up behind us. I didn't linger to learn what the men wanted. Instead, I hopped back into the driver's seat and calmly continued south, watching in my rearview mirror as the petroleum police tailed us until we'd left the property. Remarkably, in a water-filled ditch right next to one of the petrochemical installations, we tallied a new big-ear bird, yellow-crowned night heron. Just what it was doing in a ditch next to an oil refinery mystified us, but we are glad to add it to our big year list.
You know, I'm an angler, and I have made it a point, in the same way that you do with birding, is when I travel, I bring my fly rod. And there are times when I have to reconcile my carbon footprint. And I'm just wondering, how do you hang out with your passion also requiring these flights to go to far and distant places?
It's a really good question, and one that I think about a lot. I kind of have two thoughts about it. One is that I try to combine a lot of our birding with work trips that I would be doing anyway, and thus at least reduce or keep from having to do a separate trip to do it. The other thing is that because I burn up all these fossil fuels flying to different places, I feel a commitment, and I think Braden does too, that we share our love of birding and try to educate people about birds and the environment while we do this. So in a way, those efforts, whether it's writing books or talking to kids or doing our blog, are kind of paying back the incredible good fortune that we have to be able to do this.
I know at the end of the book, Braden, you proposed this Montana big year for 2017. Did you guys follow through with that, sounds like?
Yeah, we did. We didn't really mean to, but we did, mostly because of our East Montana trip that we were just talking about. And I don't remember what our total, we were something around like 220 collectively species, which is pretty good for Montana. And it was a totally different experience than, like, we had just discovered the birds of the U.S. and then we took the next year to hone our skills on the birds of Montana. And we sort of did that during 2018, too.
But I think we enjoyed it just as much as we did doing our big year around the country. That was kind of the surprising thing. Our big year around the country that the book talks about, I think, took us to a whole new level of expertise with birding. But our Montana big year took us even much farther than that. And I enjoyed it just as much, getting to know all of the Montana birds.
Braden, what's your advice to young birders?
Stick with it and know that there are definitely other birders out there. I've been lucky having Nick, just us being the same age. And in your community, there are doubtless other birders, even though a lot of them will probably be older than you. That's fine. Just get to know them and let them teach you about how to become better so that you can spread your knowledge with maybe your friends who aren't birders and get them interested or something like that.
And I'd say just accept where you're at with birding. Don't feel like you have to be the best birder or anything like that. I didn't know very much at all, and I was totally intimidated by sparrows and terns and groups like that. But with Braden's help, I've just been picking away at it, and it's amazing how much you can learn. And just have fun with it. That's the main thing. The great thing about birds is that they're the one kind of wildlife that is always accessible to you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go looking for grizzly bears or skunks or possums or anything like that. Almost anywhere you are, almost any time, there is a bird next to you. And even when I see a pigeon or a starling, I look at it and I think, wow, that thing evolved from dinosaurs. And it's here right now sitting next to me. And so it's something, it's a form of enjoyment that'll last your whole life. And the younger you start, the easier it is to learn all those birds.
Snead Collard is an award-winning author and speaker. He's written more than 80 books for young people. Snead and Braden author their own blog at www.fathersonbirding.com. Look for more information about Snead's work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.